Chapter 13. Success. The following 3 weeks were like the same day repeating itself, never changing. The window shades rose and fell. In the night I crawled from one nightmare to another. In the morning we got up and the game began again. Though was it in fact a game? I pretended to be calm, and so did Hari. This silent pact, the knowledge of our mutual deception, became our ultimate recourse. Because we talked a lot about how we were going to live on Earth, how we'd settle somewhere on the outskirts of a big city, and never again leave the blue sky and green trees, and together we dreamed up the interior of our future home and what our yard would look like. We even argued about details, the hedge, the bench. Did I believe in it all even for a second? No. I knew it was impossible. I knew that. Because even if she were able to leave the station alive, still, it's only humans that can land on Earth, and humans are defined by their papers. The first control would put an end to that escape. They'd want to identify her, so first of all they'd separate us, and that would give her away. The station was the only place where we could live together. Did Hari know that? For sure. Had someone told her? In light of everything that happened, probably so. One night, through my sleep, I heard Hari quietly get up. I tried to pull her back. Only by being silent, only in the darkness, could we still become free for a short while. Only in brief periods of distraction that the despair besieging us on every side turned into merely a momentary suspension of the torment. I don't think she'd noticed that I was awake. Before I stretched out my hand, she'd slipped out of bed. Still only half-conscious, I heard the sound of bare feet. I was overcome by a vague anxiety. "Hari," I whispered. I wanted to call out, but I didn't dare. I sat up in bed. The door to the corridor was ajar. A thin strip of light cut diagonally across the cabin. I thought I could hear muffled voices. She was talking with someone. Who? I jumped out of bed, but I was overcome by such a terrible fear that my legs refused to obey me. I stood listening for a moment. Everything was quiet. I dragged myself back to the bunk. My head was pounding. I started counting. At 1,000, I broke off. The door opened soundlessly. Hari crept into the cabin and paused, as if listening for my breathing. I tried to make it even.
"Chris,"
she whispered softly. I didn't respond. She got quickly into bed. I could feel her lying there, stretched out, while I lay next to her, immobile, for I don't know how long. I tried to formulate questions, but the more time passed, the more I realized I wouldn't be the first one to break the silence. After some time, an hour perhaps, I fell asleep. The morning began the same as always. I cast suspicious glances at her only when she wasn't looking. After lunch, we sat side by side in front of the bay window, where low, ruddy clouds could be seen drifting past. The station moved amongst them like a sailing ship. Hari was reading a book, while I was gazing in a manner that of late had become my only respite. I noticed that if I leaned my head a certain way, I could see both of us reflected in the pane, the image transparent but clear. I took my hand off the arm of my chair. In the window I saw Hari, glancing to check I was staring at the ocean, lean over the arm and press her lips to the place I'd been touching a moment before. I remained seated, unnaturally stiff, while she bowed her head over her book again. "Hari," I said softly, "where did you go in the night?"
"In the night?"
"Yes."
You probably dreamed it, Chris. I didn't go anywhere."
"You didn't go anywhere?"
"No. You must have been dreaming it."
"Maybe," I said. "Yeah, it's possible I dreamed it." That evening, when we were already getting ready for bed, I started talking again about our voyage together, about our return to Earth.
"I don't want to listen to all that," she said. "Stop it, Chris. I mean, you know..."
"What?"
"No. Nothing."
When we were already in bed, she said she wanted a drink.
"There's a glass of juice on the table over there. Can you pass me it?"
She drank half and gave it to me. I wasn't thirsty.
"Drink to my health,"
she said with a smile. I finished the juice, which tasted a little salty to me, though I didn't give it a second thought. "If you don't want to talk about Earth, what do you want to talk about?" I asked after she turned the light out.
Would you get married if I wasn't in the picture?
No.
Never?
Never.
Why not?
I don't know. I was on my own for 10 years and I didn't marry. Let's not talk about that, darling. My head was buzzing as if I'd drunk a bottle of wine or more.
No, let's talk about it. Let's talk about that. What if I asked you to?
To get married? That's nonsense, Harry. I don't need anyone but you. She leaned over me. I felt her breath on my mouth. She took hold of me so firmly that for a brief second the overpowering drowsiness I was feeling was dispelled.
Say it a different way.
I love you. Her forehead rested against my shoulder. I felt the tense flutter of her eyelashes and the wetness of tears.
Harry, what is it?
Nothing. Nothing. Nothing.
She repeated ever more quietly. I strove to keep my eyes open, but they were closing of their own accord. I don't know when I fell asleep. I was woken by the red dawn. My head was leaden and my neck stiff, as if all the vertebrae had fused into a single bone. My tongue felt rough, repulsive, and I couldn't move it in my mouth. Must have eaten something bad, I thought to myself, lifting my head with an effort. I reached out my hand to Harry. It encountered cold bedding. I jerked upright. The bed was empty and no one was in the cabin. The sun was reflected in multiple red disks in the windows. I jumped to the floor. I must have looked comical. I staggered like a drunk. I held onto the furniture, grabbed hold of the locker. There was no one in the bathroom, or the corridor, or in the workshop, either.
Harry!
I shouted, standing in the middle of the corridor and flailing my arms wildly.
Harry!
I croaked one more time. I already knew. I don't remember exactly what happened next. I must have run half-naked around the entire station. I remember I even burst into the cold room, then the last depository, where I hammered on the closed door with my fists. I may even have been there more than once. The stairs echoed. I fell over, jumped up, hurtled off somewhere else, till I came to the transparent bulkhead beyond which was the hatch to the outside, a double-reinforced door. I pushed against it with all my strength and shouted, wanting all this to be a dream. And someone had been with me for some time and was tugging at me, pulling me somewhere. Then I was in the small workshop, my shirt wet with icy water, my hair bedraggled. My nostrils and tongue were stinging from surgical spirit. I was half lying on something cold and metallic, and Snout, in his stained linen pants, was bustling about by the medicine cabinet, tipping something over, the implements and glassware making a fearful clatter. All at once I saw him in front of me. He was staring into my eyes, hunched over and intent.
Where is she?
She's gone.
But Harry...
Harry's gone, he said, slowly and distinctly, bringing his face close to mine as if he delivered a blow and was now observing its effect on me.
She'll come back,
I whispered, closing my eyes, and for the first time I was truly not afraid of it. I'd lost my fear of her ghostly return. I couldn't understand how I'd once been so frightened of it.
Drink this.
He handed me a glass of warm liquid. I looked at it, then all of a sudden flung the contents in his face. He took a step back, wiping his eyes. When he opened them again, I was standing over him. He was tiny.
It was you!
What are you talking about?
Don't lie, you know what I mean. It was you talking with her the other night. You made her give me a sleeping draught for the...
What have you done with her?
Tell me!
He felt in his breast pockets and took out a crumpled envelope. I snatched it from him. It was sealed. There was nothing written on the outside. I tore it open. A sheet of paper folded in four fell out. Large, rather childlike handwriting in uneven lines. I recognized whose it was.
Darling, it was me who asked him to do it. He's a good man. It's awful that I had to deceive you, but there was no other way. I ask one thing of you. Listen to him and don't hurt yourself. You were wonderful.
At the bottom there was one word that had been crossed out. I managed to make it out. She'd written, Harry, then erased it. There was one other letter that looked like an H or a K, which had been turned into a blot. I read it again, and
one more time, then yet again. By now, my head had cleared too much for me to get hysterical. I couldn't even manage a groan. I could barely speak.
How?
I whispered.
How?
Later, Kelvin. Keep it together.
I am. Tell me how.
The Annihilator.
What do you mean? What about the apparatus?
I asked with a start.
The Roche machine was no use. Sartorius built another special destabilizer, a small one. It only operates over a range of a few yards.
What happened to her?
She disappeared. There was a flash and a puff of wind, a faint puff, nothing more.
Over a short range, you say?
Right. We didn't have the materials for anything bigger.
Suddenly the walls began to lean in on me. I closed my eyes.
Lord, she... But she'll come back.
No.
What do you mean, no?
No, Kelvin. You remember the rising foam? Since that time, they haven't come back anymore.
They haven't?
No.
You killed her,
I said quietly.
Yes. Would you not have done so in my place?
I jumped to my feet and set off walking faster and faster, from the wall to the corner and back again. 9 paces. Turn. 9 paces. I came to a halt in front of him.
Listen, we'll submit a report. We'll demand direct communication with the board. It can be done. They'll agree. They'll have to. The planet will be excluded from the Convention of the Four. All means will be permissible. We'll bring in antimatter generators. You think anything can resist antimatter? Nothing can. Nothing. Nothing.
I was shouting exultantly, blinded by tears.
You want to destroy it?
He said.
What for?
Go away! Leave me alone!
I'm not going.
Snout!
He looked into my eyes.
No,
he said with a shake of the head.
What do you want? What do you want from me?
He retreated to the table.
All right. We'll submit a report.
I turned around and began pacing again.
Sit down.
Get off my back.
There are 2 matters. The first are the facts, and the second are our demands.
You want to talk about that now?
Yes, now.
I won't, understand? I don't care about any of that.
The last communique we sent was before Gabarian died. That was over 2 months ago. We need to establish the exact sequence of events surrounding the appearance of...
Will you not stop?
I grabbed his arm.
You can beat me if you want, he said. I'm still going to talk.
I let go of him. Do whatever you want.
The point is, Sartorius will try and conceal certain facts. I'm almost certain of it.
And you won't?
No. Not anymore. This isn't just about us. It's about... You know what it's about. It demonstrated rational activity. A capacity for organic synthesis of the highest order. Something quite unknown to us. It knows the composition, the microstructure, the metabolism of our bodies.
Fine, I said. Why stop there? It performed a series of experiments on us, a mental vivisection based on knowledge stolen from our heads and paying no attention to our own purposes.
Those aren't facts. They're not even inferences, Kelvin. They're hypotheses. In a certain sense, it did pay attention to what was desired by a closed, hidden part of our minds. These could have been gifts.
Gifts? Dear God!
I burst out laughing.
Stop it!
He exclaimed, gripping my hand. I squeezed his fingers, pressing harder and harder till his knuckles crunched. He was looking at me through narrowed eyes, without wavering. I let go of him and moved off into the corner. Standing with my face to the wall, I said,
I'll try not to be too hysterical.
Never mind all that. What are we going to ask for?
You decide. I can't. Not right now.
Did she say anything before?
No, nothing. As for me, I believe an opportunity has arisen.
An opportunity? What opportunity? For what?
Oh,
I said more quietly, looking him in the eye because I had suddenly gotten it.
Contact? We're back with contact. Haven't we had too much already?
You also, you yourself, and this whole madhouse. Contact? No, 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 count me out.
Why? He asked, completely calm. Kelvin, you keep insisting on treating it as a person, now more than ever. You hate it.
And you don't? I snapped.
No. Kelvin, come on, it's blind.
Blind? I repeated, unsure whether I'd heard right.
Of course, in our understanding of the word, we don't exist for it the way we do for each other. The surface of the face, of the body, which we see, means we encounter one another as individuals. For it, this is only a transparent screen. After all, it penetrated the inside of our brains.
All right, but what of it? What are you getting at? If it was able to create a person who didn't exist outside of my memory, bring her to life, and in such a way that her eyes, her movements, her voice...
Keep talking, man.
I am talking. I am. Yes, so then her voice, this means it can read us like a book, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, that if it wanted to, it could communicate with us.
Of course. Isn't that not obvious?
No, not in the slightest. It could simply have taken a procedure that didn't consist of words. As a fixed memory trace, it's a protein structure, like the head of a spermatozoan or an ovum. After all, in the brain there aren't any words, feelings. The recollection of a person is an image written in the language of nucleic acids on megamolecular asynchronous crystals. So it took what was most clearly etched in us, most locked away, fullest, most deeply imprinted, you know? But it had no need whatsoever to know what the thing was to us, what meaning it held. Just as if we were able to create a symmetriad and toss it into the ocean, knowing the architecture and the technology and structural materials, but with no understanding of what it's for, what it means to the ocean.
Quite possibly, I said. Yes, that's possible. In such a case, it had no... Well, perhaps it had no intention of trampling on us and crushing us the way it did. Perhaps. And it only unintentionally... My lips began to tremble.
Kelvin.
I know, it's fine, it's nothing. You're a good man, it's good, too. Everyone's good. But what for? Explain it to me. What for? Why did it do it? What did you tell her?
The truth.
The truth?
The truth? But what? You know. Come to my room now. We can write the report. Come on.
Wait a moment. What are you really after? Surely you're not planning to remain on the station.
I want to stay here. Yes.
Chapter 14. The Old Mimoid. I was sitting by the big window and staring at the ocean. I had nothing to do. The report, which had taken 5 days to write, was now a bundle of waves speeding across the void somewhere beyond the constellation of Orion. When it reached the dark, dusty nebula that extends across 8 trillion cubic miles and swallows every signal and light ray, it would hit the first of a series of relays. From there, from one radio beacon to the next, in leaps of billions of miles, it would hurtle in a vast arc all the way to the last relay, a metal container packed tight with precision instruments and equipped with the extended muzzle of a directional antenna, which would compress it one more time and fling it further into space, toward Earth. Months would pass, and an identical packet of energy, trailing a wake of shockwave distortions through the gravitational field of the galaxy, would be shot from Earth, would reach the edge of the cosmic cloud, squeeze through it, fortified by the series of slowly drifting beacons, and with undiminished rapidity would speed on towards the double suns of Solaris. Beneath the red sun, the ocean was blacker than ever. A ruddy mist melted the place where it met the sky. The day was exceptionally hot, as if presaging one of those extremely rare and unimaginably violent storms that strike the planet a few times a year.
There are reasons to believe that its only inhabitant controls the climate, and itself causes the storms. For several more months I would be gazing from those windows, observing from high up the sunrises of white gold and oppressive red, mirrored from time to time in some fluid eruption, in the silvery bauble of a symmetriad,
following the journey made by slender rapidos leaning into the wind,
encountering half-degraded, crumbling mimoids. One day the screens of all the visiphones would start to flicker. The entire electronic signalization system, long dormant, would spring to life, set in motion by an impulse sent from hundreds of thousands of miles away, announcing the approach of a metal colossus that would lower itself over the ocean with a prolonged thunder of its gravitors. It would be either the Ulysses or the Prometheus, or another of the great long-distance cruisers. When I climbed the accommodation ladder from the flat roof of the station, on board I'd see ranks of bulky white-armored automats that do not share mankind's original sin, and are so innocent they carry out any command to the point of destroying themselves or any object lying in their path, if their memory, oscillating in crystal, is so programmed. And then the ship would move off, noiselessly, faster than sound, leaving behind it a cone of reverberations splitting into bass octaves as it reached the ocean, and the faces of all the humans would brighten for a moment at the thought that they were returning home. But I had no home. Earth? I thought about its great crowded, buzzing cities, in which I would become lost, almost effaced, as if I'd gone through with what I wanted to do that second or third night, thrown myself into the ocean, where it rocked sluggishly in the darkness. I'd drown in people. I'd be a reticent, observant, and therefore valued companion. I'd have many acquaintances, friends even, and women, maybe even one woman. For some time I'd have to force myself to smile, say hello, get to my feet, perform a thousand trivial actions from which life on Earth is composed, till I stopped being aware of them. I'd find new interests, new pastimes, but I wouldn't give myself over to them completely, not to anything or anyone ever again. And maybe I'd stare into the night towards the place where the darkness of the dusty nebula blocks the light of two suns like a black veil. I'd remember everything, even what I was thinking now, and with an indulgent smile in which there was a hint of regret but also of superiority, I'd recall my follies and my hopes. I absolutely did not regard that me of the future as anything worse than the Kelvin who was prepared to do anything in the cause of so-called contact, and no one would ever have the right to judge me. Snout came into the cabin. He looked around, then stared at me. I got up and went up to the table. Did you want something?
Am I right in thinking you don't have anything to do? He asked, blinking. I could give you, there are some calculations that need running, not that they're urgent or anything.
Thanks, I said with a smile, but that's not necessary.
Are you sure?
He asked, looking out of the window. Yes, I've been thinking about various things, and
I'd rather you didn't think so much.
Then you have no idea what this is about. Tell me, do you believe in God? He gave me a sharp look.
Come off it. Who still believes these days?
Unease flickered in his eyes. Well, it's not so straightforward, I said in a deliberately light tone. I don't mean the traditional God of terrestrial beliefs. I'm no specialist in religion, and I may not have come up with anything new, but do you happen to know if there ever existed a faith in a defective God?
Defective? He repeated, raising his eyebrows. How do you mean? Well, in a certain sense, the God of every religion was defective, because he was encumbered with human qualities only magnified. The God of the Old Testament, for instance, was a hothead who craved servility and was jealous of other gods. The Greek gods had just as many human imperfections, with their quarrelsomeness and their family squabbles.
No, I interrupted him. I mean a God whose deficiencies don't arise from the simple-mindedness of his human creators, but constitute his most essential, immanent character. This would be a God limited in his omniscience and omnipotence, one who can make mistakes in foreseeing the future of his works, who can find himself horrified by the course of events he has set in motion. This is a cripple god, who always desires more than he's able to have, and doesn't always realize this to begin with. You know, who has built clocks, but not the time that they measure, has built systems or mechanisms that serve particular purposes, but they too have outgrown these purposes and betrayed them, and has created an infinity that, from being the measure of the power he was supposed to have, turned into the measure of his boundless failure.
Once there was Manichaeism,
Snout began hesitantly. The guarded reserve with which he'd been treating me in recent days had disappeared. But this has nothing to do with good and evil, I interrupted him at once. This god doesn't exist outside of matter. He's unable to free himself of it, and that's all he wants.
I don't know any religion like that, he said after a moment of silence. Such a religion was never necessary, if I understand you correctly, and I'm afraid I do. You're thinking about an evolving god who develops through time and grows, mounting higher and higher levels of power toward the awareness of that power's impotence? Well, this god of yours is a being who has entered godhood like entering a blind alley. And when he comprehends this, he yields to despair. Well, fine, but surely a despairing god is a human being, my friend. You're thinking about human beings. This isn't just poor philosophy, it's even poor mysticism.
No, I insisted, I'm not thinking about human beings. Perhaps in certain features that might match the provisional definition, but only because it's full of holes. A human being, appearances to the contrary, doesn't create his own purposes. These are imposed by the time he's born into. He may serve them, he may rebel against them, but the object of his service or rebellion comes from the outside. To experience complete freedom in seeking his purposes, he would have to be alone, and that's impossible, since a person who isn't brought up among people cannot become a person. One has to be a being devoid of plurality. You follow?
Oh, he said. Right away, I should have...
And he pointed out the window. No, I disagreed. Not that either. At the most, as something that in its growth missed an opportunity for godhood, having retreated too soon into itself. It's more of an anchorite, the hermit of the universe, not its god. It repeats itself, Snout, whereas the one I'm thinking about would never do that. Maybe he's coming into existence as we speak, in some corner of the galaxy, and before long, in a fit of youthful intoxication, he'll start extinguishing some stars and lighting others. After a certain time, we'll notice it.
We already have, said Snout sourly. Novas and supernovas. Are they candles on his altar, according to you?
If you want to treat what I'm saying so literally.
Perhaps Solaris is precisely the cradle of this divine infant of yours, added Snout.
An ever more distinct smile was ringing his eyes with little creases.
Perhaps in your conception this is the origin, the seed of the god of despair. Perhaps its exuberant childhood is way beyond our comprehension, and everything our libraries of Solariana contain is merely a catalogue of his infant reflexes.
And for a while we were his playthings, I finished. Yes, that's possible. You know what we just managed to do? Create an entirely new hypothesis on the subject of Solaris, and that is no small achievement. Right away you have an explanation of the failure to make contact, the lack of response, certain, let's say, extravagances in its treatment of us, the mind of a small child.
I don't need to put my name to it, he murmured as he stood by the window.
For a long moment we gazed at the black waves. On the eastern horizon a pale, elongated smudge could be seen through the mist.
Where did you get that idea of a defective god?
He asked suddenly, not taking his eyes off the emptiness bathed in light. I don't know. It seemed to me very, very authentic, you know. It would be the only god I'd be inclined to believe in, one whose suffering wasn't redemption, you know, didn't save anyone, didn't serve any purpose, it just was.
A mimoid,
Snout said ever so quietly in a different voice. What was that? Oh, right, I noticed it before.
Oh, it's really old.
We both gazed at the misty red horizon. I'm going to go fly there, I said unexpectedly. All the more because I've been on the station the whole time. This is a good opportunity. I'll be back in a half an hour.
What did you say? Snout opened his eyes wide. You're going out there? Where to?
There. I pointed at the indistinct flesh-colored shape looming in the mist. What harm could it do? I'll take the small helicopter. It'd be ridiculous if one day on Earth I had to admit that I'm a solaricist who never set foot on the planet. I went up to the locker and started picking out a set of overalls. Snout watched me in silence, then eventually said,
I don't like this.
What? I turned around with the overalls in my hand. I was overcome by an excitement I hadn't experienced in a long while. What's the problem? Come on, cards on the table. You're afraid that I'll... No, that's absurd. I give you my word I wouldn't. It hadn't even occurred to me. No, really no.
I'll go with you.
Thanks, but I'd rather be on my own. After all, it's something new, something completely new. I was speaking quickly as I pulled on the overalls. Snout went on talking, but I didn't really listen as I hunted for what I'd need. He went with me to the docking bay. He helped me wheel out the helicopter from its hangar into the middle of the launch pad. As I was putting on my spacesuit, he suddenly asked,
Does a man's word still carry any value with you?
For God's sake, Snout, are you still on about that?
It does. I already gave you it.
Where are the backup canisters?
He didn't say any more. When I'd closed the transparent cockpit cover, I signaled to him.
He turned on the lift, and I slowly rose to the roof of the station. The engine sprang to life with a lengthy growl. The three-bladed rotor started spinning, and the craft rose up, oddly light, leaving behind it the ever-shrinking silver disk of the station. It was my first time alone over the ocean. The effect was completely different than what one experiences watching through the windows. This may also have been because of the low altitude. I had dropped to less than 300 feet above the surface. It was only now that I not only knew, but actually felt, how the alternating crests and troughs of the vast expanse, with their oily glister, moved not like a marine tide or a cloud, but like an animal. Constant, though extremely slow, contractions of a muscular naked torso. That was what it looked like. The top of each wave flamed with red foam as it turned over lazily. When I altered course to head directly towards the slowly drifting island of the Mimoid, the sun hit me in the eyes. There was a flicker of bloody lightning in the convex windshield, while the ocean itself turned inky blue with spots of dark fire. The arc that I described somewhat unskillfully brought me far to windward, the Mimoid left behind as a broad, bright patch whose irregular outline stood out against the ocean. It had lost the pink hue the mist had given it. It was yellow as dry bone. For a moment I lost sight of it, and instead I caught a glimpse of the station in the distance where it seemed to hang, suspended right over the ocean, like a huge zeppelin from the old days. I repeated the maneuver, concentrating intently. The solid mass of the Mimoid, with its grotesque vertiginous shape, hove into view. I suddenly worried that I'd clipped the topmost of its bulbous ledges, and I brought the helicopter up so abruptly that it juddered as it lost speed. My caution was unnecessary, as the rounded summits of the bizarre towers sailed by far below me. I guided the craft alongside the drifting island, and slowly, foot by foot, I began to reduce altitude till the crumbling peaks rose above the cockpit. It wasn't big. From one end to the other it measured perhaps 3/4 of a mile, and no more than a few 100 yards across. There were some narrower places where it was likely to break up before long. It must have been a fragment from an incomparably larger formation. By Solaris's standards, it was a mere splinter, a remnant. God knows how many weeks or months old. In amongst the stringy protuberances, right next to the ocean, I discovered a sort of shore, a few dozen square yards of rather steep but smooth surface, and I directed the helicopter there. Landing proved harder than I thought. I came very close to catching the rotor on a wall that suddenly rose up before my eyes, but I nailed it. I turned the engine off at once and flipped up the cockpit cover. Standing on the wing, I made sure the helicopter wasn't in danger of slipping into the ocean. The waves were licking at the jagged edge only a dozen or so yards from where I touched down, but the craft stood firmly on its broad landing skids. I jumped onto the earth. What I'd taken before for a wall, the thing I almost crashed into, was a huge osseous sheet, thin as a membrane and honeycombed with holes, that stood vertical and was covered with swellings that resembled balustrades. A gap several yards wide cut across this whole multi-story surface diagonally, and like the large and irregularly placed holes, showed what lay beyond. I climbed up the incline of the closest span of the wall, discovering that the boots of the spacesuit had an excellent grip, while the suit itself did not hinder my movements. Finding myself 4 stories above the ocean, I turned to face the interior of the skeletal landscape. It was only now that I could get a proper look at it. The similarity to an ancient city half in ruins, to an exotic Moroccan settlement from centuries ago that had been brought down by earthquake or other natural disaster, was astounding. I could see with the greatest clarity the twisting labyrinth of streets partially blocked by rubble, their steep winding descent toward a shore washed by clammy foam, higher up the still intact battlements and bastions, their rounded foundations, and in the bulging or concave walls, the dark openings like broken windows or defensive slits. The whole island city, leaning heavily to one side like a sunken galleon, proceeded in senseless motion, turning very slowly, as could be seen from the apparent movement of the sun in the sky, which produced a lazy play of shadow across the inner reaches of the ruins. At times, a ray of sunlight would slip through to reach the spot where I was standing. I climbed higher still, at considerable risk, till a fine powder began to crumble from the excrescences protruding over my head. As it floated down, it filled the crooked gullies and alleyways with great billows of dust. A mimoid is, of course, not actual rock, and its resemblance to limestone ends when you take a piece in your hand. It's a lot lighter than pumice, small-celled, and hence extraordinarily airy.
I was so high up now I could feel its movement. It wasn't just floating forward, driven by the blows of the ocean's black muscles, who knows where from or where to, but it was also tilting, first one way, then the other, exceptionally slowly. Each of these pendulum-like swings was accompanied by the drawn-out, glutinous sounds of yellow and gray foam dripping from the shore as it rose away from the ocean.
This rocking motion had been given it long ago, probably when it was born, and it retained it thanks to its huge mass. Having observed as much as I could from my elevated vantage point, I climbed carefully back down. It was only then, strange to relate, that I realized the mimoid did not interest me in the slightest, that I had come here to encounter not it, but the ocean. I sat down on the rough, cracked surface a few yards from the helicopter. A black wave crawled sluggishly up onto the shore, spreading and at the same time losing its color. When it retreated, the edge of the previously untouched rock was marked with trembling filaments of slime. I moved further down and reached out my hand to the next wave. It faithfully repeated the phenomenon that humans had first witnessed almost a century before. It hesitated, withdrew, then flowed over my hand, yet without touching it, in such a way that a narrow layer of air remained between the surface of my gauntlet and the inside of the covering, which instantly changed consistency, turning from liquid to almost fleshy. I then raised my arm. The wave, or rather its narrow tongue, followed it upwards, continuing to encase my hand in an ever more transparent, dirty green encystment. I rose to my feet. Otherwise I wouldn't have been able to lift my arm any further. A shaft of the gelatinous substance stretched like a vibrating violin string, but did not break off. The base of the entirely flattened wave, like a strange creature waiting patiently for the end of these experiments, clung to the shore around my feet, also without coming into contact with them. It looked as if a ductile flower had grown out of the ocean, its calyx encircling my fingers in such a way that it became their exact negative, though without touching them. I stepped back. The stem of the flower shuddered, and as if reluctantly, it returned toward the ground, elastic, swaying, unsure. The wave gathered, drawing it into itself, and disappeared from the edge of the shore. I repeated the game until at some point, like 100 years ago, one of the waves receded indifferently, as if having had enough of the new experience, and I knew that I'd have had to wait several hours to revive its curiosity. I took my seat as before, but as if changed by this theoretically familiar phenomenon that I had provoked. Theory was quite incapable of conveying the actual experience. In the budding, growth, and spread of this living formation, in each of its movements separately and in all taken together, there was something one was tempted to call a cautious yet not timid naivety, as it strove frantically and rapidly to know, to take in, and unexpectedly encountered new shape. Then, in mid-journey, it had to withdraw when it was in danger of transgressing certain boundaries established by a mysterious law. This agile inquisitiveness was so utterly at odds with the immensity that stretched to every bright horizon. I had never before been so aware of its vast presence, its powerful, inexorable silence breathing evenly through its waves. Staring in wonderment, I was descending to regions of inertia that might have seemed inaccessible, and in the gathering intensity of engrossment I was becoming one with this fluid, unseeing colossus. As if, without the slightest effort, without words, without a single thought, I was forgiving it for everything. For the whole of the final week I behaved so sensibly that the distrustful glint in Snout's eye eventually stopped harassing me. On the outside I was calm. Secretly, without being fully conscious of it, I was expecting something. What? Her return? How could I? Each of us is aware he's a material being, subject to the laws of physiology and physics, and that the strength of all our emotions combined cannot counteract those laws. It can only hate them. The eternal belief of lovers and poets in the power of love, which is more enduring than death, the finis vitae sed non amoris that has pursued us through the centuries, is a lie. But this lie is not ridiculous. It's simply futile. To be a clock, on the other hand, measuring the passage of time, one that is smashed and rebuilt over and again, one in whose mechanism despair and love are set in motion by the watchmaker along with the first movements of the cogs, to know one is a repeater of suffering felt ever more deeply as it becomes increasingly comical through multiple repetitions? To replay human existence, fine. But to replay it in the way a drunk replays a corny tune, pushing coins over and over into the jukebox? I didn't believe for a minute that this liquid colossus, which had brought about the death of hundreds of humans within itself, with which my entire race had for decades been trying in vain to establish at least a thread of communication, that this ocean, lifting me up unwittingly like a speck of dust, could be moved by the tragedy of two human beings. But its actions were geared towards some purpose. True, even this I was not completely certain of. Yet to leave meant to strike out that perhaps slim, perhaps only imagined chance concealed in the future. And thus years amid furniture, objects that we had both touched, in air that still remembered her breathing? In the name of what? The hope of her return? I had no hope. Yet expectation lived on in me. The last thing she had left behind. What further consummations, mockeries, torments did I still anticipate? I had no idea, as I abided in the unshaken belief that the time of cruel wonders was not yet over. Zakopane, June 1959 to June 1960.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Tom Pyle. Copyright, 1961, by Stanisław Lem. Translation copyright, 2011, by Barbara and Tomasz Lem. Audio recording copyright 2011 by Audible, Inc.